once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I can tell you that it really is exciting today.
Yes.
See, I went to pull the microphone
in the wrong spot.
I went to pull the microphone down where it would be in front of my mouth, and it came off the stand, so I was left holding the microphone in my hand.
Just act like you're making a speech somewhere.
47 years ago.
I don't think he had a microphone. I think that's what the...
Well, I'm pretending like I'm making a speech someplace in Gettysburg. Well, I would have to have an address in Gettysburg.
Right.
Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach, this is a disclosure, by the way, is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that does business all over the place and advises people and manages money for higher net worth people, for higher invested net worth people, something like that.
Right.
And secondly, nothing we say on here should be construed to be investment advice, because it isn't. It is tended to be educational. We're trying to make it entertaining, but we are failing miserably at it. We have been, 14 years?
Yeah, failing miserably at being entertaining for 14 years.
Yes. We've been doing this for 14 years, and we have yet to hear the first laugh track in the background, so I think we probably are miserable failures.
We need to have a canned studio audience. That's what we need, just to buy the can. It's just hard to find cans.
I have looked in the canned goods section of the grocery stores, many grocery stores, and I have yet to find canned audience or laughter. I'm told that it exists, and I've done extensive research to try to find it, but I haven't. The other thing is that the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. And we would love to hear your questions, comments, thoughts, or exclamations, or whatever else you want about anything to do with the economy, economic issues, investing, anything of that nature. And we would love to have you stimulate our otherwise somnolent brains and give us some indication that we should talk about something that's interesting to you. I have anecdotal information that there are people who regularly listen to this program who never call in. But that's okay. Today is Saturday, May 27th. And if it is Saturday, May 27th, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. Again, the telephone number is 254-773-1400 here at the Personal Wealth Coach.
Okay.
What has happened this week? Okay.
Yeah.
The S&P 500 Stock Index, otherwise affectionately known as SPX, finished the week at 2415.82. Isn't that exciting?
It's horribly exciting.
Let me tell you what's interesting. Yeah, it was up 1.43% since last week, which is sort of interesting. If you multiply that times 52 weeks, you get an astonishingly high rise in the market. But it's actually up about 7.91% year to date, and better yet, 15% from this point last year. As we approach the end of the first half of the year, an interesting little statistical historical thingy is that it's 23 times in the last, I don't know, long time, like since the beginning of the century or something, the market, the S&P 500 or its predecessors rose this much in the first 6 months of the year. And in 22 of the 23, and I may have this number slightly wrong, it may be 20 out of 22, but it's something close to that, it went on to rise 9% more before the end of the year, which suggests to me that we could have a really, really big shoe here today. We could have a really good year. I don't think anybody would complain. And it sounds absurd to think that we would get an 18% rise in the market until we realize that a year ago it was 15% lower than it is today. And then there's the question that, okay, is this like a bubble from the 1990s where the stock market is already overpriced and continues to rise because it continues to rise? And there's a lot of debate about that. And that's a very good thing, because that means that there's a lot of people who are very, very worried that the stock market is about to turn downward and fall into the pits someplace.
No, which got, means it on can't. That on that subject, this is a really good thing. I've been tracking this for a while. But
a good thing?
Yeah, it's a very good thing. It's a very good shoe, if you, as you like to say.
Is that related to thingies?
Could be.
Okay,
could
right.
be. It's the Lipper is a company out there that has nothing to do with lips. You would think.
Start to say Lipper is a company with a really silly name.
Yeah, it's got a silly name, but they track a lot of stuff. They track mutual funds and they track what things are going on, where money's going, and that sort of thing. And Lipper comes out weekly with a fund flow data, the U.S. fund flows, and it's basically into and out of mutual funds in the great big wide world of the United States economy. And for the past 4 weeks, we've got about a $17 billion have left equity funds at the same time that between taxable and non-taxable bond inflows, we've got about the same amount going to bonds. So just when basically almost every expert in the world is saying that be careful with bonds, we have the American public as a whole selling out of equity positions and buying into bonds.
Yes, and
just like what happened when all of the experts in the world were saying real estate prices are absurdly high, massive amounts of money were going into real estate.
And the nice thing about all of this, I mean, we're worried about bonds.
We are worried about bonds. Evidently, other people are worried about the stock market at the moment.
But a lot of experts are worried about bonds.
Yes, very much so.
And then a lot of other experts are worried about stocks. They're too high, and you should be really cautious. And
that's really good news.
Everywhere I read, the experts are worried, and the bull market climbs a wall of worry.
Right.
So we're actually – and I know this is going to sound very, very strange. Well, maybe it won't. I don't know. As long as there's this much warning and worry that things are too high, the stock market's too high, we probably won't get any massive decline in the stock market. I suspect somewhere around we're going to get another few hiccups. That just happens. We had a day last week when the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 200 or 300 points suddenly, and then spent the rest of the week almost recovering, and then this week recovered. An interesting thing about this 2415 at 0.82. It's first off, the S&P 500 hitting 2415.82 is an all-time record high. Get that? I just said that. But if you were to search right now, and I did, you'll find precious little noting that we just broke a record in the S&P 500. As a matter of fact, this is the 20th record-breaking high that we've had this year. So the news media gets tired of reporting, you know, S&P 500 hits record high number. And that is sort of an interesting thing. Instead, we're going to worry about a whole lot of things instead of noting that the S&P 500 hit a record high. Now,
right.
Once the headlines start saying record high,
it really is the news line everywhere.
And people are saying this could go on forever. We have a new normal where the stock market will rise at double-digit rates into eternity.
When that happens, that's when we get scared.
Yes, that's when we get scared. And there's a difference between scared and worried. Minor worry hovers around in the back of my head all the time regarding the level of the stock market. Actually, when the market is really far down is about the only time I'm not worried about the market going down, because it already did go down. And I think, and we have observed over the years, that what we said in the past tends to be accurate, so we probably ought to go back and look at it. And what we said is we are transitioning early this year, late last year, we were talking about transitioning from a recovery into an expansion, and we are now in expansion mode. We still have vestiges, particularly in the housing market, of recovery mode.
Right.
Where we're still trying to recover from the Great Recession.
And this is important for those listeners out there that are saying, what do you mean expansion mode? There are still places all over the country that have – there are places all over the country that have not recovered. You are correct, hypothetical
yes,
listener
right,
that is not really saying that. But if you were in this conversation and you were in my head, you would. Yes, there are places, Detroit being one of them. Detroit is the easiest one to talk about. Puerto Rico is another one.
I got another one for you.
Okay.
Taylor.
Most of Illinois. Taylor what? Taylor.
Holland.
Holland and Taylor, Texas. Yes.
Yes. Yes. They're still trying to recover from the Great Depression.
Right. This is something that happens.
They still haven't recovered.
Every major change in the economy is in the source of the production of the economy. And every time that happens, we have whole areas that were devoted to another portion of the economy that die. And that's a normal and unfortunately healthy thing for the economy. If we kept Detroit as Motor City and we kept trying to build cars there the way we used to build cars, we would not be the leading economy in the world. We're really good at recognizing when things need to move on and then moving on. It's painful. And I realize that people say, what do you mean really good? People got laid off. They didn't have a choice in it. The vast majority of the people that got laid off, even in Detroit, now have jobs. Not in Detroit in most cases. The population of Detroit has dropped significantly. But the concept of where they are is more important than how they were laid off. In most of the world, people live in the village they were born in forever. In the United States, it's relatively rare for that to happen.
I'm getting this flashing sensation.
Yes, there's a caller. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. It seems like in the early to mid-90s, every company, or most companies, were out there splitting their stocks regularly, and that seemed like that's all but dried up. What's changed, and how come companies aren't splitting stock prices? So hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. That's a good call.
That
good
is a
question.
Good question.
Let me tell – shall we begin
He's
with
going
what is
– to tell?
Let's talk about what a stock split is, and we got another caller coming in real quick.
Okay, so we're gonna put your question about why stocks are not splitting – in the hold basket, and then we're going to pick up this caller. Caller, you're on the air. Nope.
Not on
caller.
The air.
Okay, so we can get back to why stock splits are dead.
Okay. Stock splits, by their very nature, are very strange creatures. When a stock split happens, and there's different ratios they can do it at, so we're going to stick to the most simple, the 2-to-1 stock split. Say you want lots of people with small amounts of money to be able to invest in your company. There was a time, even in my professional memory, and I'm not as old as old Baldy across from me here, there was a time in my professional memory that something called odd lots were not permitted at all in certain trades. An odd lot is any number of shares less than 100 in any company. Because this was done in a non-computerized fashion, and if there was a computer, it was a clunky thing with the green letters on a black screen. And it's really hard to do math when you're putting in a lot of decimal points, and it's happening on split-second type situations. So they would charge extra for odd lot sales, odd lot purchases. You would have an extra commission charge, which, you know, if you wanted to buy 5 shares of a company, it would cost a lot more for the trade than if you wanted to buy 100 shares. For the same trade price, you could buy a lot more shares. Now, the price of the trade itself is determined by the price of the stock. So that's a separate issue. But the cost of just buying it, not the price, but the transaction cost, was much higher, or used to be much higher, for odd lot trades. And so when a company was doing really, really well, its stock price is going up, and if they felt like their shareholders were less moneyed, they had less money to invest, they wanted to keep the price per share low. So they would, if you had a share of the stock and it was worth $100, they would say, we're doing a stock split. Now you have two shares. You have exactly the same percentage vote because we doubled everybody's shareholding, but it drops the price in half. So now you have two shares for $50. You still have $100 of the company. Nothing has changed except for if you have a low amount of money, you could invest and buy more shares. You still get the same percentage for voting.
There's a really big, two big elements, at least as reported by the Wall Street Journal, in the death of stock splits. By the way, only two companies have split their stocks this year. And at this point in the late,
reverse splitting is happening more
right,
than
but,
splitting.
But the in the late 1990s, at this point, 6 months into the market, typically about 93 companies, according to the Wall Street Journal report, would have split stocks. And here's the reason why. Every time a stock split back in the 1990s, a lot of what are called mom and pop individual investors would jump in and buy it because it split.
They didn't know that they weren't getting anything different than
right.
before the split. It
but
was
they,
just a different number. It wasn't a different ownership.
But they built up a pattern, and the pattern was every time the stock split, the stock would go up quickly because a lot of people would buy the now cheaper stock, seeing it as a discount and 50% off sale on the stock. And it was the prestige of owning the stock and things like Dell and so on. Now, today, the prestige is reversed. Amazon is almost at $1,000 a share, and that's making headlines, which is advertisement for Amazon, which is advertisement for Amazon stock. So the prestige of going to $1,000 a share is something Amazon wants to see. They don't want to drop it to $500 or $250. The other thing, and this is probably a major issue here, most of the buying that they're trying to encourage is done in index funds. The individual investors are, in many cases, rushing to index funds. And index funds find it a lot less expensive since they're charged by the trade, not by the price of the share. They find it a lot less expensive to buy shares at $1,000 a pop than they do if they're $100 a pop. Matter
right.
of fact, it costs them 10 times as much money to do a transaction for a $100 share with the same amount of money, the same amount of dollars. It costs them 10 times as much to buy a $100 stock as it does to buy. Now, when we talk about fractions of a cent, but what's happening is the index funds are competing on fractions of a cent.
Yeah.
And so it's cheaper to trade $1,000 shares than it is $100 shares for the same amount of money. It's exactly the reverse of what happened in the 1990s when it was cheaper to trade smaller shares in round lots.
You were just saying, just before this whole thing, that in the 90s we had 96 stock splits by this point in a year. And at this point we've had two stock splits for the year. The reverse stock split has been happening. There's dozens of those just in May. A reverse stock split is if you have two shares worth $50 a piece, they reverse stock split it, and now you have one share worth $100. And it's nothing has really changed in your ownership of the company, except the price has got a different multiple. It doesn't make you wealthier. It doesn't make you poorer. There is no transaction cost involved. There is actually
– there will be when you sell it, though.
When you sell it, It'll cost less. It used to be the other way around, and that's really the big thing. It has to do with how people are purchasing their investments. A lot more people are doing it through index investing and that sort of thing than used to be.
If you see stock splits come back into vogue, be afraid. Be very, very afraid.
Yes.
Because they're Warren Buffett in 1984 made a famous statement. He said that he wasn't going to split Berkshire Hathaway stock, which is astronomically priced today.
It's like in the hundreds of thousands of dollars a share.
Because he didn't want to attract the kind of investor who bought because of a stock split, because they were buying for an irrational reason. And he said the problem with that kind of investor is they will also sell for an irrational reason. This is one of the big things that psychologically goes on out there. And you may think this is a little strange, but if you bought Amazon at nearly $1,000 a share and you bought, let's just say you did this and you bought 25 shares of Amazon, $25,000, you are, this is psychology, investor psychology at the basic level, you are far less likely to sell on an impulse $1,000 share than you are a $1 share or right. even a $100 share. So that makes the stock price sticky. It reduces volatility. And if you look at this index called the VIX, the volatility index on the stock market, you'll see it's amazingly low. One of the reasons, at least hypothetically, hypothesized, for it being really, really low is stock prices haven't been splitting. They're relatively high, which means people are reluctant to do trading in individual. Individual investors are reluctant to trade stocks.
Yeah, Berkshire Hathaway A shares are $248,540 right now.
Which means that
per share.
Pretty much most people would need to get a mortgage in order to buy and pay for it over a 30-year period.
And the idea there is that when you go to sell that share, it's a big deal. It's not a whim. You don't say, I'm going to sell $248,000 worth of investments. Yeah, you know, I think I should sell that day. It's a little warm outside. That's not, and unfortunately, when people mm-hmm. are making decisions on lower priced stock, even though you could have $248,000 worth of Berkshire Hathaway, it's a lot easier to sell $10,000 of it. In fact, what we were just joking about this yesterday. There's kind of a $10,000 make your eye boggle trade that people are afraid of. So people will call in and say, I'd like to make a $5,000 sell this week, and then call back the next week and say, I'd like to do another $5,000 sell. And when we come back to them and we say, you know, you've made $10,000 of sells the last couple of weeks, and you need to make sure that you remember what that was for and look ahead and see, is this going to happen again? And this is part of the planning process. What is it you needed it for? And they say, no, I didn't do a $10,000 trade. And that's part of behavior, is that it's a lot easier to look at two $5,000 trades as being not that big a deal than to look at one $10,000 trade. This is a thought experiment that is going to help people understand this a lot better. You've probably heard me say this before, but Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He is a psychologist. He wrote the book after the fact. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow, and it's basically a huge compendium of his work. He's one of the fathers of behavioral economics, which is the area that I spend most of my time researching. He talked about an interesting fact, and I run this kind of thought experiment with a lot of my clients, that we're really, really good at calculating ratios, at calculating percentages. Is it a big percent or a little percent? If it's a big percent, we should do it. If it's a little percent, no, don't do it, or vice versa. If it's going to hurt me a big percent, don't do it. So this is the experiment, and you can follow along. You can answer either as yourself or as the typical person, if you wish.
Do I need to use a Homer Simpson?
No, not Homer Simpson at all, because there are people with MBAs that answer it this way.
Sure that Homer doesn't have an MBA?
He might. He's working in a nuclear power plant same position for many decades, so he's not got a lot of upward momentum.
But he's figured out how to keep his kids from growing up.
Right. Okay, so here's the thought experiment. We'll use you. Let's say that you wish to buy a new stereo. It's okay. A nice new stereo. Say it's got speakers that play outside and they look like rocks. It's a big fashion thing these days. They're Bluetooth speakers that look like rocks that work really well, and you can put them all in the backyard. They're waterproof and soundproof. Wait, right. No, you don't want speakers to be soundproof. Okay, they're waterproof, and it's a really nice stereo system. You've been wanting the stereo system for a while.
Actually, if you talk about a telescope system.
Okay, we're going to use stereo because this is one that is not a one-time big deal purchase. It's one that you want, but it's not one that is life-changing.
Okay.
So you know that you can just drive down the street 5 minutes and buy that stereo system for $350. Or you can drive 20 minutes up to Temple from Salado and buy it for $250.
Mm-hmm.
Would you go to Temple and buy it for $250?
Yes.
Okay, so you saved $100. Congratulations. Because
it cost me less than $100 to drive to Temple.
Right. Okay, so now you've come back home. You've got your stereo system. And unfortunately, you now need to buy a new car.
To go with the stereo system?
Well, it's irrelevant about the stereo system.
It was the drive to Temple that wore my car.
Yeah, your car is now worn out. Right. And you know what car you want. Right. You know the price of the car.
Right.
The color, the texture, the taste. Wait, not the taste. No tasting the cars. But all the factors that are important to you about the car, you know them. You've priced them. You look at it and you say, just down the street, 5 minutes away, for $30,350, there is this car. It's the perfect one. It's the one you wanted. However, if you drive 25 miles down to Temple, the same car is available for $30,250. Are you going to drive to Temple for it?
What's the difference between them?
$30,350, $30,250.
I would you mean to say, okay, the factor that would pop into my brain right there is if I buy locally something that big, I'm going to pay the taxes.
Okay.
But they would go to the local government as opposed to going to Temple's government.
All right.
So I would tend to buy the one here, not because of the $200 difference.
It's not $200, but that's a normal mistake people make. That's a when we're looking at – we tend to make math mistakes on bigger numbers even if the difference is a small
$100
number.
Difference.
Yeah, it's a $100 difference.
For the $100 difference – first, as Jeff McClure, I gave you a reason I would buy here. Okay?
Right.
Another reason would be basically I would say, and here's the reason I would tend to buy here rather than there. For starters, in Salado where I live, there are no car dealers, so it'd be kind of hard.
Well, maybe if somebody's selling it on an online service. USAA has a car selling service, so we'll assume
but you
did
still got to go get it wherever it is.
It's in Salado. It's 5 minutes away.
I would tend – I'd just be straight up, I would go to Temple.
Okay. The vast majority of people would use your first several excuses and would not go to Temple.
But my reason – and since you're asking me, my reason be very simple. Where I purchase the vehicle, I will probably get, since there's service, comes free service for several years.
Right.
Not
necessarily, but go ahead.
But let's just say because I did buy a new vehicle.
You're putting extra things in the contract.
Okay.
That's not part of the quiz. There's no service contract associated with the quiz.
Fundamentally, if I were imagining I was John Q. Public, what I would think about is the carrying cost on the loan for however many years.
No.
No. I would think about I wouldn't think about the price of the vehicle.
Right.
I would think about what is the monthly payment on that vehicle.
The result comes back on this experiment the same way if you're buying it with cash or you're financing it. And that is the vast majority of people will not drive the 25 minutes to save $100 when it's part of a $30,000 purchase.
Yep. And I probably
But they
wouldn't
will
either.
Do it when it's part of a $300 purchase. It's the same $100. It's your $100. But that's not how we think.
Right.
We think in percentages. We're really good at thinking in percentages. We can say this is going to be really bad. This is going to be really good. We're not good at saying this is going to be a little bit bad or a little bit good. That's not part of our decision-making process.
And I tend to think I'm not Joe Typical anyway, so.
So what I'm saying there is that it's easier, if you've got a big portfolio, to make little trades in that portfolio because it's not part of the big. It's a small thing. Whereas if you had an account that was only valued at $10,000 and you said, even if you've got a $1 million portfolio, there's an account that has $10,000 in it and you've been investing in that account for a long time and you go to sell it, you go, oh, I don't want to sell it. That's the whole thing. Versus taking $10,000. I'll take it out of the $990,000 account. I don't want to take it out of that account. Well, why? It's the same $10,000. It may even have the same investments in there. Because those numbers are important to us, and closing an account or selling a share worth $248,000 is much more damaging in our mind than selling a share worth $10,000 or a share worth $3,000 or a share worth a dollar. In fact, people sell shares in the penny stocks as if they are not worth anything, even though you can own a lot of penny stocks and make it worth something. Not that I absolutely, by the way, do not recommend owning penny stocks in any volume, much less large.
Well, pennies lose money.
Because pennies.
No, they're just a money-losing operation because it costs more than a cent to make a penny.
I lose a lot of pennies, and that I've lost all my cents.
Probably a lot of truth in that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got some commercials to play. Now that we've talked about splits and psychology.
We have some other things we want to talk about, but the telephone number is near. Remains 254-773-1400 if you call the Personal Wealth Coach right here, radio program, if today is May 27th. And you can talk to us, and we'll talk about the stuff that you want to talk about as long as it's not team sports.
All right. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, Jeff and Jake.
Ooh, it's a flying fox.
Yeah. How come you know my voice so well? I just wanted to tell you, I just caught the last little bit. I tuned you in just a few minutes ago, and you were discussing the studies that made of customers that would do this or do that, and I had a chuckle. I mainly agreed with you, Jeff, when you said you didn't consider yourself as normal.
I think we all agree with that.
Well, I used to have a serious problem, but now I'm normal. Oh, excuse me.
Well, you know, we ought to know by now that these so-called studies and polls that are taken are more likely to be wrong than right, especially after this last election. But I wanted to add a little something maybe that, I was in business. I had a TV shop in Houston for a few years, and it taught me a whole lot about people's buying habits that you otherwise would never collect on a poll, and I'd like to share one with you. It was when VCRs were new, and everybody was considering buying one, and I had one in my shop, priced at I think $5.95, which was just about 10% over my cost. Well, a customer comes in one day and he's looking that over real good, and I said, "Sir, can I help you?" He said, "Well, I was looking VCR, but you know, there's a guy down the street, he's got the same thing on for $4.95." I said, "Oh, really?" I knew it couldn't be true, but I went along with it. "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, why don't you go down there and buy one from him?" He said, "Oh, well, he's out of stock." And I said, "Oh, that's not the end of it." I said, Oh, I see. "Well, when I'm out of stock, I sell him for $3.95. And you know what? Didn't get it.
He
didn't catch on.
You know, you got it. I realize why he wouldn't catch on, too.
You come back when I'm out of stock, and I'll beat that guy's price.
Yeah, and there is this very fake, that's the term we're using today, fake news, assumption most people have that there's some kind of gigantic conspiracy going on and that retailers are charging twice as much as they need to charge, and they have 100% markups, which would be impossible because you can't get 100% markup. You can have a 50% markup. But the point is, there's this conspiracy theory mindset among many people that says that the really smart people have some kind of special deal they get on stocks, and they have a special deal they get on VCRs, and they have a special deal they get on something else, and that the system, including retail shop owners and so on, are just ripping off the common people, and there's some way that you could buy that for $100, that you could sell it for $100 cheaper and still make a big profit on it. And there's fundamental belief that they have. It's false, but they have this really fundamental belief that somehow there's a insider special deal that they're not getting.
Yeah, that's true. I can tell you that I was a dealer for a line of computers, and the market up on those was 35%. Good luck getting it, but that was, you know, that was the suggested retail price.
Mm-hmm.
And also, what a lot of customers don't realize is that if a fellow's got something for sale in his store, he really needs to know. He's got various items in his store. He needs to know his cost of that item when he starts dickering for a price. And a lot of retailers will have a code that would indicate what he paid for it. Now, I had one in my store, and I had a code on everything that it was a four-letter code, and the code is made up of something that you can remember. Like, my code was fresh candy. Now, fresh is, that's 10 letters, and each one represents a number. Like, F is a 1, you know, and it goes on, so you'd put those code letters on an item so you would remember exactly what you paid for it. Well, I pulled that on a guy over in New Orleans that was selling furniture, antiques, and so forth. Well, I got to looking at his code, and I broke the code because I knew what those four letters stood for. All I had to do was figure out a word or two words that represented all 10 numbers. And this guy caught me doing that, and what I found out, he was the price on an item that he was selling for $1,000, he paid $500 for it. And I got to say that that's 100% markup.
No, that's a 50% markup. Seriously.
Well, if he paid $500 and he's selling for $1,000,
the markup is a percentage. If you ever, markup is a percentage of the sale price, not the percentage of the wholesale price.
Well, okay, whatever you say.
All right, it's just accounting rules, okay?
All right, but anyway, he and another guy invited me out of his store. He thought I was a competitor or something. I was just there while my wife was shopping and, you know, standing around with nothing to do. So I broke the code on his price, and they don't like that.
Yeah. Well, but, have you been out buying anything recently?
No, I have not. I shop at. I don't really do that. But you're talking about cars?
Anything.
I priced a car in Killeen, but I come back and bought it in Temple.
Hmm.
Because it was local.
Okay, that makes sense.
And besides, I saved a couple hundred dollars on it.
Okay.
You know.
Well, good to hear your voice.
Well, I'm doing all right. How are you feeling, Jeff? You've been sick.
I am getting better.
All right.
Kind of like the economy. I'm not all the way up to where I'd like to be, but I'm a lot better than I used to be.
Are you still in astronomy, or have you picked up a new hobby?
No, I'm still making valiant efforts to capture stray photons that have spent several million years getting here.
If you really want to annoy him, just refer to all of that as astrology with a straight face. It's great.
I couldn't do that, Jay. I couldn't get my face that straight. Well, anyway, I just called in because, you know, I have a following.
You do?
Yeah. Every time I call in on your show, there's people say, "Oh, I heard you yesterday on Jeff and Jake's show."
Well, cool.
I don't know that they heard us, though. That's the thing.
Well, they report they heard me, I'm getting some kind of notoriety out of
that.
Well,
your
good.
Title is the famous flying fox. I mean, it's famous
well,
is the first
know,
part.
I started something here several months ago. I called it JD's Coffee Break, and I meet at Henderson's Cafe every Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock. And I've got about 8 or 9 guys that show up there on a regular basis now.
How much did Henderson pay you to say that on the radio?
No, I didn't mean to.
They ought to give you free coffee after that plug.
There's no commercial involved here. Nobody's.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And you have had no contact with the Russians?
I just wanted to. We talk about such as that.
Okay.
This is the type of talk that people do. I used to do at coffee breaks, you know, when you sat around and figured out how to solve the world's problems, and especially the company you worked for. You could really solve all those problems if you were just in charge.
That's right. And
but coffee breaks are supposed to be for you.
And those, since coffee breaks have stopped, productivity's gone up.
Well, I'll drop in and see you guys in Salado.
All right.
Sounds good.
One other thing. When I lived in Salado one time, you know, and they were put in that new store there, the Brokshire Brothers store.
Right,
something.
Yeah.
Before they kicked out the old one, they put in a service station, gasoline.
Still there.
And yeah, well, I pulled in there one day to get gas because it had the cheapest gas in town. You know,
in Salado, that's not saying much, but go ahead.
Well, I'm an ex-Exxon employee, and I get 10% at the Exxon station. But this price on this, the advertised, was way down there. So I pulled in and going to fill up. Guess what? They didn't have any gas.
Well, right. That's because they were out of stock. They could sell it at a low price.
And they priced it cheap when it's out of stock.
That's right.
See you guys later.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
That was the famous Flying Fox, who's, among other things, quite an author. I have enjoyed reading a series of books that he's written over the years. Telephone number in here, the personal wealth coach, is still 254-773-1400.
He ended that with gas, so let's go to oil, if you don't mind, instead of the other forms of gas, which are
slimy.
Much more noxious.
That's a pretty slimy subject.
Yes, it is. Oil. The price dropped after OPEC agreed that they would continue to limit the supply.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that reasonable? And there's an easy answer to that, but we're going to have to wait till after the caller.
It's called shale.
All right. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just, you were talking about oil, and I noticed that El Presidente Trump wants to, sell off half of the strategic oil reserve.
That's because prices are down?
Yeah, you want to give us history on that?
Okay.
Why do we need it? Why do we need that?
Okay. We can talk about that.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Oh, thank you.
Why do we need the strategic oil reserve? Well, that was this event that happened in the early 1970s where we got our oil cut off.
The oil embargo. The Arabs were really upset at us and said, you don't get any more oil. And it caused big gas lines and the economy came to a screeching something. And it wasn't quite a halt, but it was definitely a slowdown. And Congress set the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit based on that. And we created a larger version of the informal strategic oil reserve because we didn't want our military response to be limited by a foreign set of countries that we didn't really agree with. Part of the reason why the embargo happened is because we liked Israel and they didn't like Israel. So for political reasons, they shut off oil to us, which could have put us in a really nasty defensive position. We were in the middle of a Cold War at the time.
And the reason that we have it today is a little more complex in that we are dependent, even though we produce enough oil in the United States to keep us going, the way the logistics is set up, we still import oil, refine it, and sell it in the United States. And it's a logistics issue, not a supply issue. But still,
let me throw in a really easy example of this. Say somebody's working on a farm, just real quick example, and it's a green beans and peaches farm. But they produce enough green beans and peaches to make all their own green beans and peaches. Does that mean that anybody that works there never buys any green beans from elsewhere or doesn't work with other farms to sell green beans and peaches? So the products get mixed together. And that's what happens in refining as well.
And so it's one thing to have oil, and it's one thing, and it's another thing to have the oil where the refineries are that are capable of processing that oil, and the pipelines to get it to the right place. For instance, the East Coast has a lot of imported oil and gasoline coming to it, whereas we're exporting it from the Gulf Coast. Now, what that means is, if for some reason, like war, the gigantic supertankers that haul all this oil and gasoline around suddenly stopped hauling it around because they were afraid they'd get sunk, we would suffer some pretty severe shortages in places in the United States. And having a strategic reserve to draw on at that point makes a lot of sense.
Now, the fact that we have the tremendous reserves that are coming from shale, which is what we were about to talk about when the caller called in, is part of the reason why it's less important what the president is doing now, because we can replenish that oil reserve very quickly based on domestic production. If we went to a war footing, we would get that domestic production concentrated into the defense area.
One of the things that, and the reason it probably won't happen, by the way, the president probably doesn't understand economics particularly well. Were he to suddenly announce that we are selling off half of the strategic reserve.
He did.
Well, but he said he wanted to.
He wanted to, yes. He announced that he wanted to, which is the same as not announcing anything.
But if some reason we said we're going to put a few billion barrels of oil on the market, the price of oil would drop precipitously. Profits at oil companies and pipeline companies across the United States would drop precipitously. It would upset the world market pretty dramatically.
It wouldn't upset the world market as much as our market, though.
Right. And so the bottom...
Because this oil is here, and we would have to ship it somewhere else.
But his reasoning, at least that was what was explained from the White House officials, his reasoning in saying that was he wants to build a border wall. He wants to spend a lot more on defense. He wants to spend a lot more on infrastructure, and he wants to cut taxes at the same time. Well, those produce huge deficits, and huge deficits, there's a law against producing huge deficits. It takes a supermajority in Congress to pass huge deficit spending. And he said, oh, well, we can make up the difference by selling about half the oil reserve. But there's the problem with that statement is the assumption is that the price of oil around the world would be unaffected by the fact that we dumped a huge amount of oil onto the market.
It's not billions. The current storage design capacity, if it is absolutely full, it's 713 million barrels. That's a lot of oil.
Okay, so.
But it's not.
It's less
billions.
Than a billion.
So, it would affect basically even back when, for instance, George W. Bush released some of the strategic oil reserve. So did Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
When gas prices get really high, it's a kind of a wave of the hand. Here, I'll try to do something. Our daily usage is enough that even half of the strategic oil reserve is going to be. Get this, a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, I got that.
So what's going on there is even if we could keep the price from dropping drastically, if we did let me do a quick calculation.
But the bottom line to it is it was a kind of a knee-jerk reaction of, hey, we can sell something that belongs to the federal government and make up the difference between the taxes we collect, which he wants to reduce, and the money we spend, which he wants to increase.
So he could come up with about, if he didn't move the market, which he would, that
right.
big a release of oil would move the market, even if it was just slipping around. He would raise about $16.8 billion.
Which I hate to say this, but in terms of the federal budget, it's peanuts.
I bought a nice bomber.
Yeah. So it's a psychological call. Whether or not it's a good idea. Jake was talking about just a moment ago, and we're about out of time for this hour, by the way. really close, but you were saying that the price of oil went down after OPEC said they were going to produce less of it.
Well, they were going to continue producing less of it. Uh-huh. But the reality is the market kind of expected them to cut back even more because shale production is ramping up. They're loving the $50 a barrel mark. We're at about $48 a barrel, and that's hugely profitable now. It wasn't 3 years ago. It is now, and if the technology just keeps going, if they keep trying to keep the price down, then the technology is going to get even better, and we can be profitable at $20 a barrel.
Trying to keep the price up.
Yeah, keep the
production down, price up.
Well, then we'll be profitable at $20 a barrel.
Right.
Okay, well, we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give personalized investment advice to real people.
And we manage their portfolio.
Right. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we've got voicemail waiting and real live people during the week at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly at jeff at tpwc.com or jake at tpwc.com. I do encourage you to go to the webpage. We got podcasts and so on there of this program. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.